Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. This is episode 84. I'm Dan Prosser, joined once again by Andrew Frankel, who's been thinking about his automotive heroes.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we've 84 podcasts, and we've never really done this. And given that these are the people who got us interested in cars, and ultimately, I guess, are responsible for what we do now, I just thought it would be just quite interesting, you know, to do a bit of to and fro and just see who they were. And, you know, I don't know about yours, but some I've never met, others I'm related to. So it's, you know, it's kind of like they come at me from everywhere. So I just thought it might be a fun topic of conversation. I guess we'll find out, won't we?
We will, and maybe a little insight into you and I as well. So I'm curious, are yours mostly from childhood, or are some of your heroes from later in life?
No, they're either from childhood or early adulthood. They're the people who sort of, you know, in my formative years, they're the people who kind of just really sort of got me going. And well, yeah, I mean, much more so than today. I mean, there are so many people that I really admire today. Not many who I would really call, although some of them are still alive. Well, not many actually, a couple. But it is different. These are the people who inspired me, I guess. And I guess we always think back on who inspired you, not currently who's inspiring you, particularly when you're as old as I am.
Yeah, for someone to be a hero, I think they really have to leave an impression on you when you're young.
I think that's right.
And that is true of all of mine. I'm a little bit nervous about this because I fear that mine are just totally predictable, and inevitably yours are going to be the complete opposite of that.
No, they're not. I mean, you know, the names on my list will either be really, really famous people or people who no one's heard of because I know them. We will see. But I haven't got any sort of, you know, rabbits to pull out of hats, so I don't think. But, you know, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we're going to take it in turns. You'll do one, then I'll do one. You just mentioned having met them or not. I've only met one of mine, although I've sort of spoken to another one of them. So, yeah, not many. But let's crack on then. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, can I start with my father? Only because he is where it all started. Because, you know, I grew up in a family where to be completely and utterly obsessed with cars was totally normal. We used to think my mother was a bit weird because she wasn't. Yeah, and she didn't really understand it. And to me, having a passion for cars, it wasn't like it was a kind of option. It was like, you know, waking up or eating food or, you know, or anything like that. It's just something that was part of your life. It's part of who you were. And I think that with that, and that all came from my father. And where he got it from, who knows, because there was none of it in his family. But he just had some insane gene, rogue gene that he picked up from somewhere. the car. I used to call it the disease because, you know, it was something that you once you got, you never got rid of it. To the extent, I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, that when he came to his career choices, he literally had, he narrowed it down to being a lawyer or an accountant. And he decided to become an accountant because he realised he could drive between audits. That was literally it. That was the reason he became an accountant. He didn't spend much time, well, he spent a bit of time practising as an accountant, but he went off into business and other things. And he was just, he was completely obsessed with cars. He also had this extraordinary never-say-die attitude to stuff. He just wouldn't let himself be defeated by stuff. So he used to, his pride, he once he made a bit of money, years and years and years ago, when these things were much more affordable than they are now, he bought himself a vintage Bentley because that's what he really wanted. And he'd go off and he'd just do insane things. Like he'd just go and drive it across America or he'd drive it around South Africa. And he would, you know, he went and did the Mille Miglia, the retrospective thing in it, lots of times. And one year, actually it wasn't long before he died actually, they said to him, Mr. Franklin, you've done this quite a lot of times, and this year, I hope you don't mind, but we're going to let some other people have a go. So we're turning down your entry this year. And he just thought, sod it, I'll go anyway. So he got in this thing, drove it across Europe, turned up at scrutineering, and they said, Mr. Franklin, it's lovely to see you, but you haven't got an entry. And he said, well, here I am. Give us an entry. And they went, all right then. And they created a space for him. They had one more car on the event that year than they would usually because they just couldn't believe that he'd, you know, that, and that was, and I think if you have that in your blood, and I'm nothing like as determined as him, but that's, I guess it is that desire, that drive just to not just have a passion, but to indulge it. That's the thing, isn't it? It's not enough to just love cars. It's in any way you can, at whatever level you reach in terms of how good you are as a driver or how much money you have and therefore the cars you can afford and what you can do, just get out there and do it. And he taught me that. So, I'll be grateful to him to that forever. Over to you.
What a brilliant place to start. Well, hang on, let me just ask. So, I mean, he went to work as an accountant.
Yes.
So presumably a relative, was he a sensible man, straight-laced at all?
No, at all, or, no. He was... He was a gifted communicator, and he ended up teaching accountancy. He started a company which taught people how to become accountants. And to this day, it's very interesting. To this day, less now because you know it was a long time ago. But there used to be a stage where I'd go anywhere. Usually happened at things like the Goodwood Festival of Speed, and I'd be there, and somebody would come walking up to me, and I go, "Oh, look, somebody recognised me." And they come up to me and go, "Are you Andrew Frankel?" And I go, "Yes, I am Andrew Frankel." Yeah, and then they say, "I just want to tell you that if it wasn't for your father, I wouldn't have had the life that I have now." And they all said the same thing. He said because he was the only person on the planet who could make accountancy funny. He just made accountancy entertaining. I mean, it sounds like an almost impossible brief, doesn't it? But he managed it. And he used to make jokes. And he used to write books about accountancy with jokes in them. And because he made it less, because accountancy, I think, is not known to be the most fascinating of occupations, but he made it entertaining, and you know that was his great strength, and that's been his legacy, and you know it was great for me, but you know there are thousands of people that he taught who wouldn't have got through their final exams but for that, so yeah, they owe him that as well.
I wondered if he was quite a buttoned-down character who happened to have this rogue streak in him
Totally flamboyant. Utterly flamboyant. A bon viveur, a larger-than-life character. Nuts, in many regards. Nutty enough to choose to do accountancy so he could drive cars.
And did he race at all? Okay, so you mentioned the Mille Miglia, but did he do circuit racing? Or
he did one race in his life. He kind of thought, I better go and try it. And he did. I've got a photograph of him, actually. He did it in some pre-war Aston Martin at Silverstone, a club race at Silverstone. And he's there, and he's got a black helmet on, which doesn't have a visor. And he's wearing a big jumper and this huge steering wheel. And he's off doing, and he won, actually. Hang on. I might have it somewhere. I'll find it in a minute. Yeah, over there, there's a tiny little trophy. In fact, I'm going to get it. Hang on.
Okay, Andrew's gone off to look for this tiny little trophy. He's got a whole stack of shelves behind where he sits. He's just sat
down. This probably
down.
Isn't going to work unless you watch these on YouTube. But if you are, this is it. This is the trophy he won that day, which is an Aston Martin radiator. And the little plaque, which used to be there with his name on it, is gone. But yes, and he did one race, and he won a little trophy. He clearly came somewhere. And at the end of it, he decided that racing, how did he put it? Taxed both himself and his machinery further than either of them cared to go, so he was never going to do it again. So he didn't. He did one race, but...
So he did one race, came away with a pot and called it a day.
100% pot collection record. That's not bad. There aren't many racing drivers who can say that.
No. Well, do you know what? I bet he had the time of his life messing about with cars with his three car mad sons.
He did.
Given that he loved them that much.
That's... He absolutely did. Yeah, I mean, when we started racing, he did get terrified, though. I mean, I can remember when my oldest brother, my old brother, Jonathan... used to race, Alphas in club racing, and did quite well, winning his class in the championships and that sort of thing. But I can remember my father came to see him race at Brands Hatch one day, and he'd had an almighty accident just before my father turned up, and me having to go to the gate to intercept him, lest he see the record. So just meeting him, go, hi, how are you? Don't worry, he's had a bit of an off, but he's fine. And my father was a complete nervous wreck around us when we were doing that. But, he was a remarkable bloke.
Well, that is a brilliant place to start, and I feel I'm going to let us down now. So, yeah, mine goes well back to childhood, probably even before adolescence, when I was a kid. I loved cars, as we all did back then. But I've written about this before on the Intercool, actually, the Drive Nation back then. I am a first generation petrol head, so I'm the total opposite of you. I didn't have any kind
of... So you're my father.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah.
So I didn't have any kind of car upbringing, I didn't have anyone in my family really who enjoyed cars and who could help me indulge my passion for cars, or even, no one in my family owned interesting stuff that we could go out in and have fun with. And so, as you do when you're a kid, you sort of search around, don't you, for some figure to latch onto and to, so that you can express your enthusiasm for whatever it is. And can you imagine, right? I was obsessed with cars. I'm 12, 13.
Were you obsessed with cars from your very earliest memory? I don't know how old you were when you first had memories, but maybe you were four or something. Were you obsessed with cars then?
I was, and I was one of those kids who could recognise cars very quickly. Count them off. I could tell, even when I was tiny, tell everyone what they were. I always remember in primary school when I was probably eight, I would always just ask the other kids, "What kind of car does your mum have?" or "What kind of car does your dad have?" and they'd say, "A red one." And I'd say, no, what colour? I want to know what kind of car it is. And they'd say, Nissan Micra. And I'd go, oh, good. Is that the current one or is that the previous shape one? I just knew. I don't even know where that came from, because it's not like I was reading car magazines. But
did you have
somehow,
a mate whose dad had a cool car or anything like that?
No.
Did you ever go into
nothing
cool
at all?
Stuff? No.
Do you know what? It's the weirdest thing. And I've written about this again before. I harassed and bullied my father into... he wasn't interested in cars, and I was desperate for him to develop an interest. And, he is very sweet, very loving, and he did his best. And so one day he decided that he took me to a motor show, and it was when the Mazda RX-8 was new, and it was on a turntable, and he said, "Oh, I quite like that." And I thought, oh my goodness, this isn't going to happen, is it? And he was sort of interested for a while, and I harassed him into going for a test drive, and he took me once. And I remember this so vividly. So I was probably 16 at the time, so I wasn't a really small kid at that point. And we were in the car to begin with the salesman driving, and he took us over the road, across a roundabout, put his foot down. And I just remember being forced into the back of the seat that I was in with this G-force that I'd never experienced before. What's interesting about that now is that 5 or 6 years later, I drove an RX-8, and they don't feel fast at all. They don't serve up any kind of G-force under acceleration.
No, they've
like
got
that.
No torque.
Exactly. But the thing is, I'd never, ever felt any car accelerate with any kind of enthusiasm at all. So even just the force that an RX-8 can muster, that was totally alien to me. So it just demonstrates that even well into adolescence, I'd never sat in anything quick. And so, yeah, I found being too young to drive enormously frustrating because I love cars and I had no way of getting behind the wheel of anything.
So how old were you when you drove a car for the first time?
I think I sat on my dad's lap and steered around a car park when I was, I don't know, 13, probably younger, I don't know, 10 or something. But I didn't drive a car until I was 16, until soon before my 17th birthday. So I had a very, very slow car upbringing. I didn't really have any role models around me. I wasn't ever around interesting cars.
Did you ever go to a local kart track and have a whiz round in those or anything?
I did. I went to Landau, so I was 16, and my dad took me for a few weekends of proper clubman racing. You know, I got my license and I did a few weekends, and I loved it. But my dad didn't know the first thing about it. He was paying for it, and I think it was a bit too much to ask for it to become something that we did every other weekend, for it to become a proper hobby of mine. So I was very lucky just to get to do a little bit. But yeah, I mean, and you know, they would take me to car shows now and again at the NEC or in London. And so that was how I enjoyed being a petrol head, you know, and God, it all just comes back now. And of course, when you're a teenager, the most sort of titillating aspect of car culture is, particularly back then, is the Max Power stuff, tuning cars, and you know, the sort of I don't know, the more childish aspects of it, I suppose. But to go back even further, I think it's inevitable that as a kid around the late 90s, early 2000s, when Top Gear was on TV, it was inevitable that one of my heroes was Jeremy Clarkson, and he was my first automotive hero. And actually, thinking about it now, most of my heroes are either in motorsport or more so in car media, sincerely. And Clarkson was the original one. And, you know, I loved cars as a kid, and he made enjoying cars fun. You know, when you're a teenager and he's saying silly things and acting the buffoon and being childlike around cars, the best cars in the world, having fun with them, and communicating about them in a way that was entertaining, hilarious, very enjoyable, not earnest in any way. I just adored it. And Top Gear,
you also think that the remarkable skill that he exhibited and still does was to be able to do all that, was to present cars in such a fun, geeky, silly way, and yet at the same time command total authority over a subject? You never thought he was just presenting. You never thought that he was a bloke who didn't know anything about cars. You absolutely knew that he was a car man to his boots. And so, and I think that's the thing that Top Gear presenters who haven't been crazy about cars, that's the way they always get found out, because, you know, they might be very funny, they might be very telegenic, they may have great, you know, on-screen presence. But if you don't know your subject, if you're not, and that doesn't come across, then, you know, the connection's not there, is it?
That's a very good point, because I think what he did cleverly was recognise, particularly with the new Top Gear, which is not new at all anymore, is it 20 years old or something?
Yeah.
But, you know, the studio-based Top Gear, I think he recognised that most people have a degree of interest in cars, because most of us have to drive. Most of us take an interest and pay attention when we have to buy a car. So it's on our radars, isn't it? Driving cars, it's on the radar for most of us. However, most people are not obsessed with cars the way that we are. So he recognised that if you could harness the sort of more relatable aspects of automotive and produce a show that was entertaining for the masses, while still keeping people like us amused and entertained, that you could build an enormous audience. And that's what he did cleverly. However, that would never have been possible if he didn't genuinely love cars, because it wouldn't have been authentic. He wouldn't have had credibility for us or for the more mainstream audience. So
yeah,
that's what he did cleverly.
Very good.
I remember going to, it was called MPH03. So in 2003, MPH was the live show that they did. And it wasn't the trio, actually. It wasn't Jeremy, James and Richard, I don't think. I think Tiff was there, maybe in James's place or in Richard's place. I can't remember. But this was in London, I think. And there was a car show on the side, and then you go through to the live arena and they do an hour and a half on stage or whatever it was. And I remember I had a video camera in my hands at the start of the stage, at the start of the show, when Clarkson walked through the curtain, and the I don't have the footage anymore, but the camera's shaking in my hand. My hand is shaking because I'm so nervous and so weirdly excited about seeing Jeremy Clarkson. Even now I remember it, just quivering, just could not believe that he was right there. And I, you know, particularly a little bit later on, I loved his writing about cars and about other stuff as well. I even liked his non-car stuff on TV, that talk show that he did, Clarkson. He became a total idol to me. He got me interested in car media in a big way, and he's ultimately the reason that I decided to do what I ended up doing. And that studio era Top Gear, particularly through the early years, left such an impression on me. It's responsible for so much of why I love cars and why I got into the line of work that I did.
It's very interesting because, I mean, okay, so my next nominees, so we're seeing as we're talking about car media, and I'm not going to talk too long about this because I've spoken a bit about these guys on the podcast before, and also one of them is one of our contributors. but so I'm talking about Mel Nichols and Steve Cropley, who 99% of people who listen to this will know, are the people who edited Car Magazine. Well, Mel from the mid-70s through to the early 80s, and then Cropley through most of the 1980s. And what they did is actually, they may be horrified to hear me say this, I'm not sure, but what they did was a very similar thing with print media to what Clarkson went and did on Top Gear, insofar as they were totally passionate about their subject, very knowledgeable, but they were also totally unafraid about who they offended. They were irreverent, they called it as they said it, and they were, as a result, they were just the most massive entertainers. And if you see it in the context of what they're up against at the time, you know, Autocar and Motor magazines in the, you know, in the 70s and early 80s were very, very, very dry publications. Even things like Motorsport, which were obviously for the enthusiast, you go and read those things now. I mean, they're interesting, all the information's in there, but they're hardly a, you know, a riot. And these guys came along and they just broke all the rules. They did stuff and they said stuff, and there was none of this sort of deferential cap doffing to the manufacturers. They just didn't care. And they created a form of motoring. I mean, they changed the face of motoring journalism. And some of the greatest stories of any kind I have ever read were written by those guys in Car Magazine. And because the coincidence was that, you know, I was of that age, I was at that most impressionable age, I was a, you know, I was kind of like a bomb waiting to go off. When these guys came along, I must have been, I don't know, 10 or 11 when Nichols started doing Car Magazine, maybe even younger, but at my most, I was like a sponge. I was ready to soak all this stuff up. And they were there and they were ready. And they, you know, the day of the month that Car Magazine came out was always the best day of the month. I would run to the newsagent. I would always allow myself only what to read one story before I got home. If for any reason it wasn't there, that was the end of the day. I mean, I was that bad about it. And there was this time, and again, I'll be quick about this because I've told this story before, but when I was sitting in a hamburger bar with my father in Holland Park, and Cropley walked in to collect his takeaway, and I knew it was him because he got out of his red 308, which he parked outside. And literally, my father said, "You must go and talk to him. You must go and tell him how important, you know," because my father to him, that would just be what he did because he was that kind of guy. And I was this very shy, introverted, reserved, you know, kid. And honestly, you know, he literally might have asked me to go and, you know, say boo to the Queen. I would never, ever have done it. And now I know these guys. They're my friends. Nichols, works for us. I'd love Cropley to do stuff for us, but he's tied up with Autocar. But they were the main external influences on my life when I was a kid, and genuinely without them. Actually, they probably stopped me being a motoring journalist for a bit because I was so in awe of them. I thought there's no way I could ever do that. But then when I did become one, I've tried and struggled and failed to follow their example ever since. So yeah, thanks guys.
Oh, it's so relatable. I just feel exactly the same way. So I think after Clarkson really got me interested in car media, I sort of continue on down that journey. I remember reading Top Gear, and then I think someone bought me a subscription to Auto Car for Christmas or my birthday. And so I had that for a couple of years. And same thing, every Wednesday or Tuesday, maybe even for a certain period.
It was on a Tuesday.
It would flop through the letterbox, and it was always the highlight, and I'd tear it open. And the guys in there became my heroes. And I'm not going to mention any of them because I'd have to mention you, and that would just be embarrassing for everyone. But then, and a bit later on, I found Evo as well. And when that grey plastic envelope came through the letterbox, it was an amazing thing. And you tear it open and flick through the whole thing back to front. And then the likes of Barker and Mead and Bovingdon and, you know, all those guys, again, genuinely became heroes to me and made me, yeah, really pursue this line of work. And so, as I said, a lot of my heroes were in car media and the others are in motorsport. And I'll offer you my next one, and that's Sebastian Loeb. So when I was at school, he's still my best mate. He was a grass track driver and later a rallycross driver until at 17 he became a rally driver. So he was embedded in that rallying world, and he loved it and he followed it closely. And it was him who really got me interested in rallying. And, you know, we together, once we had our licenses, we used to go to Wales Rally GB, getting up at 3 a.m, following it through the rest of the season, you know, from a distance. And I loved it. And I was just so totally besotted with this form, this discipline, of motorsport. It was brilliant. And I feel a bit sad that I missed the McRae Burns era. I just arrived a little bit too late to really capture that, to be a part of that era, you know, sort of late 90s through to the early 2000s. I arrived just a little bit later. And I really started paying attention to it just as Loeb was asserting his dominance. So he won his first title in 04, and every other one up until, well, he won 9 years on the trot. So it was around 2005, 2006 that I really got interested. And at that point, there weren't any British front runners competing for wins or for the championship. And so really, as a, you know, I realise now that a lot of my motorsport heroes, particularly in F1, are British. And I don't know why, but it's almost jingoistic. But somehow, I guess it's natural for all of us to be drawn to competitors from our own country. But I somehow was drawn to this Frenchman driving a French car. And I think it's because I could just recognise that he was so much better than everybody else. He just seemed to be faster than everyone, more consistent. He seemed unbeatable, and he changed the sport forever with this new driving style. I mean, he probably wasn't the first to introduce a circuit racing driving style to rallying, but he made it work better than anyone else before him. And it was just extraordinary to watch someone operate at a much higher level than everybody else around him who had similar or comparable equipment. And I used to write about rallying a lot. So, you know, before I started in the industry with my first full-time job at the end of 07, I did some freelance writing about rallying. And a couple of years later, I found myself doing a lot more rally stuff. So I was really embedded in that world for a while. And I had a website of my own, and one of the things I did was keep it track. It was called Mud, Snow and Tar. And I kept track
Is it still there?
No, it's not still there. You won't find a thing. you won't find a thing, sadly. And one of the things I did was keep track, not just of stage wins, the number of stage wins each driver had throughout the season, but a cumulative running total of the margin by which drivers would win stages. So if someone won 3 stages by 10 seconds each stage,
okay, yeah,
their cumulative title would be 30 yeah, seconds. And at the end of each year, Loeb was just minutes ahead of everybody else. His cumulative
probably
total
hours
would be, yeah, it would be well beyond everybody else. Just a huge, huge margin.
That's,
and I'll just sit and look at that.
That's actually, it's only when you extrapolate it over a season that you actually get a true sense. Yeah. We should do that in Formula One. And just see.
It shows you not only who's winning stages or races, but by what margin. Yeah. It's an interesting thing to do.
Yeah.
And you know, quite apart from the fact that he was clearly the best and he did extraordinary things in a rally car, he was cool in that Gallic way and didn't seem to try too hard or give too much of a shit. And I just thought he was brilliant. Definitely a motorsport hero to me.
Okay. My next one is a bloke that some people listening to this, particularly if they went to, or if they go to Goodwood, or used to go to Goodwood, the Revival and things like that a lot, but he won't be a name that's known to most, is a bloke called Michael Salmon. He was known professionally as Mike Salmon. And he was a racing driver, and he raced at Le Mans over a very long period of time. I think he did his first in about 62, 63, and I know he did his last in 84. So he raced at Le Mans 17 or 18 times over a period of more than 20 years. However, as far as I was concerned, what was best about him was he lived about 2 miles away from us. We lived in Jersey, and he was the only professional racing driver who lived on the island. And so, of course, my father went and made friends with him immediately. And they were seriously good buddies. I mean, you know, probably the best friend that each of them had on that island. And Michael ran, there was a Ferrari dealership, still is, I think, on Jersey. And he sold Ferraris, Alfa Romeos and Daihatsus, would you believe?
and of course.
To me, as a kid, I was just completely starstruck by this bloke, because he was a bloke, a racing driver. I mean, he raced Ferraris at Le Mans, and he raced Ford GT40s at Le Mans, and he raced Aston Martin Nimrods at Le Mans. And to think that, he used to come around and, you know, and come around for dinner or whatever. He played table tennis with my father a lot. And just to sort of stand there watching these two middle-aged men, you know, playing table tennis, and think, actually, that bloke's done Le Mans 20 times. And that just, like, completely blew my brains. And he was, publicly, he was unbelievably political. I mean, embarrassingly politically incorrect at times, certainly sort of later on when the world started to change and he was still capable of saying things which really you shouldn't say. But personally and privately, he was such a kind man. He and his wife, Jean, who was also an amazing racing driver, they never had children. And so we were really, really close to them. And because I was so obsessed with cars, I used to go and get on my bicycle and cycle across to the Ferrari dealership, which was only about 2-3 miles away from us. And I'd just go and sit in his office with him and just talk about cars, because he didn't have anyone he could do that with. Okay, I had my brothers and my father, but, you know, I did that with them all the time. And I'd just go and sit in this bloke's office who, you know, with pictures of his, you know, various insane things he'd raced at Le Mans. And he'd just tell me about, you know, trying to take the kink flat at 210 miles an hour in the wet in a GT40. And I'd just be sitting, and I'd just be, And he was an unbelievably brave man. He got very badly burnt at Le Mans in 1967 or 68. Basically, a mechanic had forgot to, or didn't put the fuel cap back on the car properly. And he's going down the Mulsanne Strait, whatever GT40 will do down there, plenty. 200 and something, and the whole thing goes up. And he's sitting in the car and he thinks, well, I've got to get out, but I've got to get it stopped first. And, you know, and those cars back then, it's not like they had, you know, the modern brakes. They took a long time, they took a lot of stopping. And he's sitting in it while this is going on. And he gets out, and, you know, he bore the scars for the rest of his life. Didn't stop him going back. And, you know, he was, I think he might, through his injury, I think he may have missed the year after that. But as soon as he could be, he was back. And I can remember him saying to me, when they first started talking about putting chicanes on the straight, he said, if that happens, I will never race there again. He was so old school. He was so old school. And he was a delightful man. And he raced into his, I mean, he was racing at the Revival, you know, well into the 2000s, really competitively, really quick, when he was, you know, nearer 80 than 70. And we always used to meet up, and he was a wonderful, wonderful man, and I miss him very much. And what a privilege just to be able to grow up with someone like that. I can remember once he came over for dinner, and probably lots of table tennis as well, and it was in the middle of the winter. And unbeknownst to us, while this was all going on, and this was a very rare event in Jersey, snow fell, a lot of snow fell. And he'd probably had quite a lot to drink. And at the end of the dinner, he sort of marched out to his car and, you know, suddenly trodden the snowdrift. And we said, oh, well, you're not going home. You better stay the night. Yeah, nonsense. And off he went in his Alfa Sud, which he had at the time. I can remember going out the following morning, and there was only one track through the snow, and there was his. And just watching, you could just see through his tire tracks the lines he was taking, and the way he was obviously just sort of maintaining it. And he basically drove like a rally driver all the way home, and was, of course, completely fine.
Bloody hell.
And the other thing he did, I'll shut up about him in a minute, the other thing he did, every time he came over after I got a driving licence, he'd always turn up in something different. And while he was off playing table tennis, he'd just toss me the keys to this. And it would start with little Daihatsus. The last time he did it, because by this stage I was probably in my 30s, it was an LM002.
Oh my God.
because he ran a Ferrari dealership, people would just turn up in weird shit to part exchange it. And somebody turned up on an LM002, part exchange it for a Testa Rossa or whatever, I don't know. And so he just turned up in that and said, off you go.
So wow, I went there you are on the Rambo Lambo.
LM002. So there you go. Michael Sarah.
Did he have any results? Did he have any results at Le Mans?
The best he did, he came fifth overall, sharing a 330 LMB Ferrari for Maranello concessionaires, sharing with Jack Sears in 1963. He also came, there's a great documentary called Nimrod the Mighty Warrior about Aston Martin returning to Le Mans in the early 80s with the Aston Martin Nimrod, which wasn't a works car, but it was works backed. And he shared that with Ray Mallock and with Simon Phillips. I think Tiff was in the other car, actually. There were two cars. I think Tiff was in the other one. Anyway, the one Tiff was in, I think Tiff had a puncture and it crashed. But the one that Michael's, and don't forget that this was, you know, this was 1982. So this was the first year of Group C. And so it was like 956, 956, 956. And I think they were first car home behind the Porsches, in a car that had a road car Aston Martin V8 in it. And it was based on a Lola T70 with an Aston Martin engine in the back of it. But it was the first British Group C car, you know, long before Jaguar started doing it. I think they came, I'm pretty sure they came seventh, which was a pretty good result. Yeah, good peddler.
Yeah, what a bloke. Okay, right, well, let's keep it motorsport.
Yeah, go on.
Is this guy a hero of mine? I need to think carefully about this. I think he was poised to become my hero. But at the right time, he didn't have the success that I hoped he would have. this is Jenson Button.
Oh, there you go. No, absolutely. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, so I know I said that about Loeb, even though he was dominating, and often dominance is off-putting, but I didn't find that off-putting with Loeb. However, you know, when I was a teenager and Schumacher was dominating Formula One and it seemed like nobody could get close, it wasn't that enticing a sport to me at that time. And I wasn't watching it before the start of the Schumacher era. So I was sort of flitting in and out of F1 at that time. But then Jenson came along and in around 04, he was having a good season, lots of podiums. And he seemed, I liked that he was British and he seemed funny and personable.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't the corporate racing robot that a lot of those guys are and were. It just seemed like a fun character. And then Hungary happened, 2006, when he won a Grand Prix for the first time. And it meant so much to me. I remember leaping about, just delighted.
Yeah.
And that shot of him with his helmet on after the race, out of the car, with his eyes wide, just, you know, the whites of his eyes just popping. That was my profile picture on MSN Messenger or something for a while. And so I was ready for this guy to become my hero. And I knew that he was from nearby. He's from Somerset, isn't he? I'm from Bristol. And so I was just ready for him to become my hero. And I hoped that after 2006, he'd win more races. He'd maybe compete for the championship. But then Honda happened in 2007 and 2008, and, you know, my earth dream, and he was suddenly at the back of the grid again. And that was a shame. However, of course, what happened in 2007 was that another British driver turned up, and I will come back to him later on. I just want to keep talking about Jenson for a little bit. And so Button didn't quite become that idol figure to me at that time. And then a couple of years later, 2009 happened. I was just so delighted to watch that unbelievable Braun year unfold and see him win the championship. And ever since then, you know, he's been someone who I've looked up to, respected enormously, followed his career, just enjoyed watching him on TV, if he's a pundit or if he's being interviewed or whatever. And whether or not he's a hero to me, I think that means, that's a big word, hero, isn't it?
And often overused, yeah.
Yeah, and but I remember a few months ago when I spoke to him for TI online, I did a podcast with him about his Radford stuff. And it was a really significant moment for me to get to sit here talking via Zoom or whatever it was to Jenson Button.
Yeah.
That was a really cool moment for me.
I mean, to me, yeah. I think he does qualify because actually, you know, given that he can do it in a car, given that he's a Formula One world champion, so he kind of proved himself. To me, the actually more important thing is, given that he can do that, is the person that he is. And I can remember the fortitude and stoicism with which he bore those two nightmare seasons with Honda. And I can remember, and I've told this story before, so again, I'll be brief, but going to the Festival of Speed, and I had to ask various people what the most impressive thing they'd seen all weekend was. And I can remember going up to Sterling, who I'm not going to mention because I think everybody knows he's my hero, but just going up to Sterling and say, what's the most impressive thing you saw at the festival this weekend? And he said, well, it was Jenson, wasn't it? And I went, what, did he drove up the hill really fast? And he went, no, it's got nothing to do with driving at all. And apparently they'd all gone up to the top of the hill, and you've done it, so you know what happens. You get into this massive great assembly at the top of the hill, and all the drivers get out of the car and start talking to each other. Jenson gets out of whatever he's in, and instead of talking to the drivers, just goes across to the fans. And there's a whole wall of fans behind that assembly area. And he spent all the time they were up there just talking to the fans and signing autographs, and nobody else did. And Sterling was up there and just saw this and just thought, actually, that's the real mark of a proper person, not just a great racing driver, but a proper person. So, yeah, absolutely. I completely understand why he's up there for you.
Yeah, and I love that after his F1 career, he's dabbled in all sorts of other things. Other forms of motorsport, I mean. Super GT in Japan and Le Mans and GT driving and some off-road stuff as well. So, yeah.
He loves it.
He does love it. He's one of us. He loves road cars as well. Yeah, he's up there. Right, let's have your next one.
Okay, another racing driver who sadly I never met because he got killed. Gilles Villeneuve. Jacques' dad, as we know, and to me, there was a purity and a passion about the way he went racing, which it was quite Sterling-like. But he, on top of all of that, he had this wonderfully sort of unhinged quality. You know, so he was racing sort of in. His career started in 77 when he did some races for McLaren, didn't retain the contract, and then he did five seasons with Ferrari from 78 to 82, when I would have been between the ages of sort of 12 and, well, I think I would have been 16 when he got killed. And to me, he was just, because he was so fast, I mean, in terms of raw talent, there was, I don't want to say he's the greatest that there ever was, although plenty will, because I've never believed you can compare across eras. But there was nobody out there at that time who had more raw talent than Gilles Villeneuve. I have no doubt about that at all. And yet, he was such an honourable driver. In 79, when they had the 312 T4, and Jody Scheckter was leading the championship, and Villeneuve, who probably could have overtaken him and won races, he just didn't. He just sat there. He played the dutiful number two, you know, showing that, you know, you can be a superstar and a team player at the same time. He was an intensely honourable man. He did crazy stuff on the track. I'm sure people will remember And if not, there's that footage of him at Zandvoort when, you know, he has a puncture and he's trying to get the car back to the pits, and he drives it back so far he basically hasn't got a car left by the time he gets back to the pits. And there was obviously Dijon in 1979, the wheel banging with René Arnoux, which is probably the greatest bit of wheel-to-wheel motor racing I've ever seen in Formula One. It's all on YouTube if you've not seen it. I'm sure you have. And yet he wasn't a lunatic. He cared very much about safety. He was prepared to risk his life, but he wasn't prepared to give it away. He wasn't one of these, you know, he didn't have a death wish or anything like that. He campaigned for circuit safety. But when he was in the car, he did what he had to do. And he was such a skillful driver as well. There was Jarama in 1981 when he was in the first Turbo Ferrari, the 126C, which was a pig of a car. It didn't handle at all. It had no grip. It had a powerful engine with hideous lag. And he kept, you know, five or six of the world's greatest drivers behind them, all in massively faster cars, for the duration of the race. They just couldn't get past. And it's one of the greatest feats of driving. And he didn't overtake anyone. He just stopped himself being overtaken. And nobody could say that he ever, you know, blocked them unfairly or tried to, you know, chop him up or carve him. He just drove beautifully. And I can remember when he got killed at Zolder in 82. This was after the San Marino Grand Prix, when his teammate Didier Pironi had gone against an agreement they had that if the race were secure, whoever was first would stay first and whoever was second would stay second. They were leading 1-2. And then on the last lap, Pironi overtook him and nicked the race. And Villeneuve said there and then, I will never talk to him again, because that was just not the way that you behaved. And then in qualifying for the next race, some say because he was trying to out-qualify Pironi, others not, but nevertheless, he came across Jochen Mass. Jochen was completely blameless in the accident that followed. Villeneuve died. I was heartbroken. I was absolutely heartbroken. Because, I mean, he was, other than Stirling, and in fact Stirling was more of a hero of mine in later life when I got to know the bloke, you know, back then Villeneuve was my hero, and he was gone. And I can remember being at wherever I was at school, some boys being a bit unkind and saying, God, you never met bloke, what are you so upset about? And just thinking, you guys, you will never understand, and feeling sorry for them that they could never feel that passionate about you know, something like that. And yeah, and I often wonder what he would have gone on to achieve. But, you know, back then it wasn't a safe thing to be doing.
Mm.
So there you go.
Wow, what a brilliant candidate.
And also, I then met his son, Jacques, years later, who I didn't get on with. And he was just a really difficult, arrogant. I met him with James Garner, you know, Jim Rockford at Monza. And whereas Garner was just charming and lovely and wonderful, Jacques Villeneuve just didn't want to be there. He wasn't interested in any of us. He was rude. He was dismissive. He was a pain in the ass, frankly. Anyway.
That is disappointing, isn't it?
A little bit.
Yeah, okay. So,
how much more time have we got?
Well, not much more. We'll rattle through these last few. So, it is inevitable that we sort of default to racing drivers with this sort of discussion, because a lot of what they do is fundamentally heroic to us, isn't it? But because my last one, and this is my last one, is a racing driver, and actually an active racing driver, I'm not going to dwell on Lewis Hamilton too long. But sincerely, there is nobody in the world, maybe apart from Jeremy Clarkson, who I'd be more starstruck by to meet than Lewis Hamilton. And this feels odd because, you know, he's very much an active F1 driver. But the truth of it is, when he emerged on the scene in F1, I mean, in 2007, that was when I was 20 years old. You know, I was disappointed that Button hadn't become my idol in motor racing. And I was just waiting for someone come along. Lewis is only a couple of years older than me, but he really is a hero with no qualification to me, you know. And when he burst onto the scene in 2007 and he set that incredible record of 9 straight podiums from his debut with 2 wins in there, it was just an extraordinary thing. Unbelievable thing to see unfold. And I remember being completely gutted when he slipped into the gravel trap on the pit entry in China. And then a couple of weeks later in Brazil when he didn't manage to win the championship. Sincerely gutted. And then on the flip side, you know, the following year, I particularly remember Silverstone 08 in the wet when he was just head and shoulders above the field. Just a class of one. Unbelievable how he... Well, basically, he was the only one who kept tyre temperature in the wet in those torrential conditions. And he just disappeared. And I loved his driving style, how he went about racing, how aggressive he was, how he could drive in the wet, how he could overtake, how fast he was over a lap, is. And then, of course, Brazil 2008 is that Glock last corner. Honestly, I just get chills when I think about that, because
how sorry for Felipe did you feel?
Well, not at all, because I was a Hamilton fan, you know. Harsh, but speaking truthfully,
I'd
never watched someone that I really really supported and really idolised win a championship before. And so watching Lewis win in 08 was, there will probably never be a more significant championship win to me unless one of my kids goes on and wins.
Wow.
You know, some sort of championship.
It's the fact that in later life he has used the immense power and influence that he has come to command, that he has used that to pursue the causes that are important to him. Is that relevant to you, and the fact that he's here, the fact that he's trying to be a force of good in the world beyond Formula One, does that make a difference to you, or was he always that bigger hero before any of that?
It does make a difference, and actually what I've loved over the last 15 years or whatever it is watching his development in every aspect. So, you know, he was this phenomenally quick young racing driver, this hot shoe when he appeared, and he won all those races early on, won the championship in his second season, but then he went through his sort of lean spell, didn't he, and he was making mistakes and crashing into Massa every other race, and he was tempestuous then, but also in his very early McLaren years he was a very corporate animal. At that point he was very buttoned down. And so over the years, we've watched him cut out the mistakes. There was a phase where he made fewer mistakes than anybody else, far fewer.
Yeah.
I feel like we're seeing a couple more now. But
I agree. But then again, he's under pressure now that he hasn't been under for a while.
He's under pressure now, which is probably what makes a difference. And of course, we've watched him have this enormous success beyond anybody else before him. And you're quite right. We've watched him turn into a role model. Away from motor racing, but within motor racing as well, and we've watched him develop into a man, haven't we? When he was a boy, when he emerged on the scene, and so it's the whole thing. And I know that he's a divisive character, and people don't like him for whatever reason. But to me, he is a hero. And as I said, if I had to reduce it to just two people, it's him and Jeremy Clarkson.
Blimey. I always used to blow hot and cold about Lewis. When he first came, I thought, fantastic. It's just great, because he was just so electrifying. And then exactly what you said, he went through that phase, and I actually thought that there was a petulance about him, and an arrogance and a dismissiveness. And there was a period when I really wasn't a fan. And then in recent years, I think even more now, because it's very interesting to see how he's reacting under pressure. And if you look at the race at the weekend at Mexico, he came second, and he was just so graceful about it, and I can just, you know, he's grown up and he's matured, and I think that he is, now that he is, you know, a sort of senior figure within the sport, I think he has adapted to that in a way that there was a time I never thought that he would. I admire him all the more for it, because he's been on this journey and appears to have emerged a far finer, more well-rounded sportsman than certainly I ever imagined that he would be.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, we don't have too much longer, so do you want to? I'm sure you've got plenty left.
Well, I do. I'll just do my last one, only because he's an anti-hero. And I thought we all need a good JR character in there. So Enzo Ferrari.
Brilliant.
There's a wonderful book. What's it called? I think it's just called Ferrari by Brock Yates. It's a biography of Ferrari, and it's a hatchet job. And it basically says that Enzo was an arse. And I'm sure, well, I know that there were many times Enzo behaved in a way which was, I mean, he was totally Machiavellian. He did exploit drivers. He did set one against the other. He did behave incredibly badly at times. But, I mean, what a man. What an achievement. What a legacy. I mean, Ferrari. It just says it all, doesn't it? I mean, it is the ultimate. And if you look at what he created and the way he did it, and the Scuderia, because to Enzo never had any interest in his road cars at all. He thought that people who bought Ferraris to use on the road were rich and probably not that bright. But hey, they provided the money which enabled him to go racing, so that's absolutely fine. And there's a bit of me that sneakily admires that kind of approach, because it's so focused, and the results speak for themselves. I mean, there's never been a racing car manufacturer like Ferrari. I'm sure there never will be. There are so many people who are fans of the sport around the world only because of Ferrari. And I've said this on the podcast before, I have this weird thing. You give me a Ferrari road car, I'll assess it like any other road car. Come race day, there's a bit of me that always just wants the Ferrari to win. Whoever's in it, I just want Ferrari to win, because I love Ferrari, and I always have. That's Ferrari the racing team, because there is a purity about the way that it came into being. And, you know, he did employ some great drivers, but it was Enzo who was behind all that. The other thing I would say about Enzo Ferrari is when he was making racing cars in those eras when racing was at its most dangerous, and you can't really say this about almost any other racing car manufacturers around at the time, people didn't die in Ferraris. Or if they did, it wasn't through Ferraris braking. He never made his cars so flimsy they just fell apart, because he knew that, you know, the lighter they were, the faster they'd go. He always, you know, I don't think that there is an incident of a Ferrari driver dying in a Ferrari because of mechanical failure, which is extraordinary. If you think
that's really important, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is really important. So maybe he wasn't quite as cavalier as all that. I don't know. But yeah, rightly or wrongly, and you know, he's somebody who has his advocates, and he's somebody who has his detractors. But he is a person who, through my entire life, right up to and including today, I'm sure for the rest of my life, has absolutely fascinated me. I never met the bloke. Never came close to having an opportunity. But those I know who have met him, you know, talk about this mercurial character behind the dark glasses with the blue pen in his office. And to me, that's all just part of the myth, all part of the legend. And yeah, he's absolutely a hero of mine. Whether he was a very nice person or not, that's another conversation.
Yeah, I totally understand. I totally get it. And Ferrari's an interesting one, because it's so easy to be put off by the theme parks and the aftershaves and the branded baseball caps and all that nonsense that goes with it. It's very easy to be cynical about Ferrari. And also, because if any supercar is going to be bought for the wrong reasons, it's probably a Ferrari, maybe a Lamborghini. So there is an image issue. But when you go to Maranello and you go to Fiorano and you look around and you think, that was Enzo's place, that's where he used to watch the Grand Prix on a little television.
Yeah.
It's all just so romantic. And I get totally swept
that,
up in
through
it.
Through that square archway, and you go in there.
Unbelievable.
And you're in the inner sanctum.
That'll
never feel normal to me. That will all, every time I do that, and we all try to be quite nonchalant. Oh, here we are again, back at Maranello. And in fact, we're all just going, shit, it's Maranello. And, you know, and it's right that it should be like that, because, you know, if you don't get fired up by that, you know, you're in absolutely the wrong line of work.
Totally agree. Yeah, that's a brilliant candidate. Well, do you want to mention anyone else before we finish, or should we wrap this one up?
I think wrap it up. I was going to go on about Senna, but I think he's probably a podcast on his own. So I think I'm done for now. I mean, there's so many more. We come back and do, you know, lots of other podcasts on it, but I think that's a reasonable number to be going on with.
Good, I agree. Okay, let's wrap that one up. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back to talk to you again next week, but make sure you go and rate and review the podcast, please. That does make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.